During all this, the war was still going on. You know how wars are, I'm sure. There is so much waiting, while one prepares, while things happen beyond one's control or knowledge, and then, finally, an action to take, or an assault to endure. And there is so much to do all at once, desperately. We had arrived during what seemed to be a time of waiting. "The raven does not often make a direct assault on the city," said the myriad to me on one of her visits. "I suspect he would attack more if he could. He is almost certainly planning such an attack now, which we are doing our best to prepare for, but in some respects he does not need to make such physical attacks." "I am told," I said, "that the raven of Iriden has spoken possession of the strait." The water was indeed very nearby, I had learned. Sitting, turning, outside the wall of the city, I thought that if I concentrated, I might even feel the regular pull of the tide. "He has," confirmed the myriad, "and as well he has spoken the submission of the gods of Ardvorthdir. This is where the battle happens daily. The raven attempts to make his speech true, and the gods of Ardvorthdir try to counter his speech with their own." "You'd think," I said, "that the matter would have resolved itself one way or the other by now. The raven's power would have come up short against the combined power of Ardvorthdir, or the reverse." In my experience, God's statements were generally made true as soon as possible, sometimes almost instantaneously. But of course, a statement as simple as, "I am ruler of Ardvorthdir," has, in practical reality, quite a large number of details that must be attended to make that simple statement true, and the matter becomes even more complicated if there is active, powerful resistance. Still, I was puzzled. Surely none of the parties involved are possessed of inexhaustible power to keep the question open so long. "One would think," agreed the myriad, "there is something odd in this, something I cannot explain. I would not have thought the raven powerful enough to stand against the combined strength of the gods of Ardvorthdir, and yet this has continued for years. But Ardvorthdir..." She gave a small, troubled whine. "I am hearing things I do not like the implications of."
"What do you mean?" I asked.
"Do the people who turn you ever get dizzy?" she asked.
"Sometimes. Sometimes they just need a break, but sometimes they can't walk around and round that way without becoming sick. Does my turning make you dizzy?"
Sometimes they seemed ill, or weaker than I thought they should be. For all, they were allowed as much of the food I produced as they wanted. But that was something I was thinking about, and did not see the need of troubling the myriad with.
"I don't think I can get dizzy in the same way humans do," she told me. "But it is disconcerting. You're spinning around and around even slowly when I'm used to you never moving at all. I mention it only because it occurs to me you might wish to watch these people who attend you so constantly."
I puzzled over that for a bit, and then asked, "What is it you've heard that you don't like the implications of?"
"I have not met any small gods here," the myriad told me. "None that did not come down from the north. That may not seem significant to you, but when I was here before, there were dozens of them, here and there, all through the city. Tiny things, most of them, but canny enough to stick to small favours or particular things they did well. And there were enough prayers and small offerings to keep them well enough fed. It made sense to me at the time. The large gods of Ardvorthdir are so very large, one doesn't generally trouble them for things like finding lost needles, say, or encouraging a single fish onto the hook. And there seem to be enough people in Ardvorthdir to provide very well for such small gods."
"Have you asked?"
"I asked," the myriad told me. "I have asked gods of Ardvorthdir and been told that it was because of the war, which strikes me as an evasive answer. I have asked gods of the north who are here, nearly all of whom arrived here well before we did.
A significant pause.
And learned that they have received the same answers to the same questions. Indeed, I am told that the mother of owls, on hearing this and some other things that troubled her, returned to the north, saying she had not come so far to be fodder for the gods of the shoulder sea, whether of Alvustia or Vastai.
Fodder? I asked. What other things, then, troubled the mother of owls?
She was asked, as I have been asked, if she might agree to assign her power to another god.
To what? I was astonished. Why would you do that? Is that even something you could do?
Apparently so. One might do such a thing if a particular project required a great deal of power wielded all at once, more than one god possessed. In such a case, it appears that one might lend one's power to the god who best knew how to wield it. It is, I was told, as simple as saying that my strength would be usable by some other god, which seemed to me to be a rather foolhardy thing to do, even with a good deal of qualifying statements as a safeguard. Even if one trusted the god to whom one gave one's power, the statement that was asked of me did not, in my opinion, contain sufficient safeguards. I refused and offered to assist in another way.
Have any northern gods agreed to do this?
None that I know of, replied the myriad. Indeed, it wasn't only the mother of owls who took offense. The fox with red eyes very nearly followed her. I myself considered leaving when the request was made of me.
She made a buzzing whine.
But you would have been left here with few other friends, and perhaps not enough information to protect yourself, and you cannot leave here quickly and easily.
Do you think the small gods of Alvustia were foolish enough to agree to such power lending without safeguards?
Some, perhaps, said the myriad. All? I doubt it. And now I know it's possible to give one's power. I begin to wonder if it's possible to take it.
Beneath me, the wheels and rollers groaned as my attendants pushed me around and around.
I advise you to be wary. Be wary even, perhaps especially, of the healer god. Do not say his name unless you want him to hear you. But I have found that the gods here are close-mouthed and jealous of their discoveries. There are things I have learned that I am enjoined not to speak of, and so I can say only so much to you. But keep in mind that the healer god will have told you only exactly as much as you need to do what he needs you to do. Do not, I advise you, tell that one or any other god here the whys and hows of what you can do.
I have not, I assured her.
I know, she said. I have been asked several times by several different gods, including the healer, how it is you can do this work so steadily on such a small allowance of prayers, and if the turning has anything to do with that, and if so, how. I am sure they would not have asked me if you had answered such questions yourself, but to let them continue to guess at your strength, I beg you, and be circumspect, even with me. I have made promises to conceal or reveal certain sorts of things, and I would not like to betray you, knowingly or not. For the moment, we all wish to prevent the raven from conquering, but beyond that, their interests are not our interests. Let us not forget that.
As the weeks went by, the people who pushed me, the ones who were with me day after day, became weaker and more tired. The conversations and the occasional laughter stopped, and they did not even exchange words when arriving or leaving for the day, or while they rested, where before they nearly always had. Now all of them stared dully ahead, gasping, as they slowly trudged, barely shifting me. When Oisin came to check on me, he sniffed at one of the girls who seemed to ignore his presence.
Yes. It's an illness that was quite common here several months ago, but I don't understand its cause.
Should they not be resting? I asked.
I've not noticed rest to make much of a difference with this illness, Oisin told me. And in any event, we cannot spare anyone, ill or not.
I did not argue with him or share my own thoughts, mindful of the myriad's caution. Over those weeks, I also resolved to reach the sea. I briefly considered learning to inhabit one of the gulls I occasionally saw, or an insect. But for whatever reason, the idea did not appeal to me in the least, no matter how convenient it seemed for other gods. Instead, I thought about the stone wall of the city, and how Oisin had told me, and the myriad had confirmed, that the largest of Ardvustir's streets were of stone, as were the quays of Ardvustir's harbour. I did not want to leave my stone. It felt like myself after so long. Indeed, I could not quite imagine myself apart from it. But perhaps, if I considered carefully, I could extend myself into the limestone wall beside me, into the flagstone streets, and perhaps all the way to the harbour, and feel again the wet and the waves. I moved slowly at first, feeling my way into the wall, and then waiting, growing used to stone that was not made the way my own was, stone that was largely made up of the bones of once living creatures accumulated over millennia. It was awkward and disconcerting at first, but the reminder of my old place on the seabed helped, and by the time I was ready to move to the stones of a road near the wall, I had grown more confident of my ability to extend myself this way. Still, I moved cautiously and listened and learned as I went. Ardvustir was indeed a city of multi-story buildings of brick and stone, close-packed, especially near the harbour. The bricks intrigued me. They were, I gathered, made from a particular sort of dirt and ground stone, shaped into blocks, and then heated in a very hot fire. The buildings themselves were taller than nearly any building in Vastai today, except the Raven Tower, 4, 5, even 6 stories. Some of these housed the establishments of large gods, and some of them were warehouses or the workplaces of the city's officials. But the rest were residences, either of single families or of many families dividing the levels and rooms among themselves. Often, there was a shop or workshop of some sort on the ground level, but many of these were shuttered now, there being no ships to bring silk or oranges to sell, no herds nearby to provide cheese or leather or wool. Before the war, there had been room around some of the houses for keeping chickens or small gardens, but those were long gone by the time I arrived. Nearly everyone I saw ate the food I produced. But I also saw that within the city walls, that food was mixed with dried ground seaweed before it was distributed. My attendants took their food directly from what I produced. And while I saw many people who would have been healthier and happier with more and better food to eat, I did not see anyone with a specific illness my attendants seemed to suffer from. Eventually, I reached the harbour. I did not go out into the water, but stayed there in the stones of the quay, feeling the waves wash against me, the tides rise and fall. When last I had been near so much water, there had been no question of boats. But here, there were many. Or so it seemed to me, even though I knew there were far fewer than there might have been because of the war with the Raven. Fish swam beneath the waves, though not as many as I had expected, and clouds of small jellyfish swallowing the tiny shelled multi-legged things that swarmed the water. Garbage strewed the harbour floor, piles and scatters of it, broken clay jars, pieces of sunken boats, and bones of pigs, of cattle, of humans, over which crawled shrimp and small green crabs. I was somewhat surprised those had not been eaten, but eating was not a thing I did, nor had I paid much attention to it until quite recently. So perhaps the inhabitants of Ardvuskdia did not know they could eat the jellyfish and the crabs, or did not care to eat them for some reason. The water itself was dirty with human waste, from the crews of the boats and from Ardvuskdia itself. But it was the sea, and I found I had missed it. Not enough to stir myself, to move to keep myself under the water when it drained away from where I sat, no. Still, I had missed it, and was glad to touch the water again. For all the trash and waste, it felt familiar and comfortable, in a way nothing had since I had trundled away from my hillside, the small cloud of the myriad hovering over me. That first day I reached the water, I only watched. Saw the gulls overhead, the sky and the clouds, and across the grey water, Vastai. There was no tower there, not then, just the town and its own smaller harbour. The quays themselves are not much different today, only, of course, nowadays there are far more people and ships. And there was no fortress in Ardvuskdia then, only a number of administrative buildings and god's establishments. The Raven ordered the fortress built over the ruins of several of these after the war.
"I have discovered what happened to the fields around the city," the Myriad said to me on one of her visits.
Careful to speak in that language we had first used with each other, that I was sure no one else near us could understand.
"A few years ago, whether by the Raven's interference or not, there was a bad harvest. The barley crop was poor, much of it blighted. That winter, people began to starve. The dog, along with some other gods, though I do not know precisely which ones, used some of what grew outside the walls as material for food. It was broken into quarts and gallons of barley, on which the people had subsisted. But when spring came here, there was not enough fodder for herds, nor edible plants near the city to forage, and the dog had to speak more barley into existence, at I imagine great cost to himself, so that there would be enough to plant. But again, the harvest was not sufficient to feed the city through the winter, and again the dog was compelled to use his power to provide food, thus spoiling the land even further, and making the next year's harvest even less adequate for the city's needs. And so the dog was compelled to continue as he had begun, until the land surrounding the city was, as you see it. Now the city lives mostly on the food that you are producing here, and fish and seaweed, and birds and eggs when people can get them."
Oisin's closest, most trusted attendants sometimes spoke to each other in places where I could hear them, and by now I had learned enough of the language they spoke to know what they said. When Oisin had told me that he did not understand the cause of my attendant's illness, he had spoken the strict, literal truth, but he had spoken dishonestly. He did not understand its cause, but he did in fact know, at least in a general way, what had caused it. Several of Oisin's establishment's other slaves were also ill, though not in precisely the same way as those who attended me, and the differences in their illnesses were of great interest to the healer god. None of the affected slaves were worth much, in the opinion of the people I heard discussing the matter, but the knowledge being obtained was beyond price and would be useful. "Is it the case," I asked, "that the people who have access to fish and seaweed, or who eat the food I provide only after it has been brought into the city and perhaps other things added to it, is it the case that they have for the most part not fallen ill in the same way as my attendants have?"
"Ah, you've noticed that, have you?"
asked the Myriad. I had not had to notice it. I had only to stretch my awareness into the stones of the city to hear it whispered by Oisin's own servants.
"Do you know why it is?"
"I have an idea," I said. "I am not certain."
"And did you know some in Ardvuskdia call your attendants worthless cripples and half-wits, and profess themselves glad some use can be made of them?"
I did, but did not admit knowing that, or resenting it. "They are my attendants," I said. "They do their jobs well and faithfully when they are not ill."
"Well,"
whined the myriad thoughtfully,
"I am curious why Ardvustians used to regularly fall ill this way, but now it seems only your attendants do. And I do not think the dog is sufficiently powerful to strip so many miles of land of all plants and animals on such a scale and continue his healing of wounds and illnesses uninterrupted."
"From what I know now," I said, "the methods he will have used to do such a thing will have been cruder than what I am using." This, even before some refinements I had made over the weeks, but I did not say that.
"And thus likely cost him more power. I am doing the work now, work that he told me he could not do unassisted for long." "There is something strange here. If we needed you for this work now, what god helped him before?"
"That I don't know," I said. "What is it that you are doing for the defence of Ardvustia?"
"Some of it I am obliged to keep secret," she said. "But for the most part, I am asked to make small statements to bolster the city's main defence, and I prepare for an assault that we are sure must happen soon, but do not know the details of."
She drifted a bit, with a breeze, and returned to where she'd hovered over me.
"Your attendants seem better today, now I look at them closely."
"They do seem better, a bit," I agreed. I had come to my own conclusions about the cause of the illness, had looked as closely as I could at the bodies pushing me around and around. Ah, teeth and bones felt almost familiar to me, after the mineralized shell and bone of the city wall. I'd looked and, I will say I'd tasted, for want of a better word, and I'd listened to the hurried whispered conversations of Oisin's close assistants as I stretched slowly through the stones of the city and thought about what I'd heard and seen. And then I'd changed the things I was putting in the food, just a bit. It was no longer only the sugar and protein that Oisin had judged necessary for human food. I had not said so to Oisin, partly because I did not have words for the things I had done, and partly because I thought he would be angry when he learned I had done it. But I was not willing to let my attendants continue to suffer, and even die, so that he could see the specific differences between different sorts of malnutrition. "I think they will improve even more as time goes on. Have you heard what happened to the small gods here?"
"Besides, it was the war?"
"No. Did any very small ones come south with us? Are they still well?"
"A few," she replied. "One or two who were associated with the girls from the river camp. I have spoken to them recently and they seem well, but they have been pressed to lend their power to the gods of Ardvustia, since, they are told, they are too small to otherwise help. On my advice they have refused, and have been doing what small things they could find around the city."
"I suppose we will learn more when the expected assault comes," I said. A few days later, Oisin visited me. He lay down in the sun and watched for a while as I turned, as my attendants pushed me around and around silently, slowly. "Strength and patience of the hill," he said finally. "Did you alter the makeup of the food you've been providing?"
"I did," I replied.
"It seems to be more nourishing now."
"Why did you not tell me?"
asked Oisin.
"Did I need to?" I asked.
"You were very busy. It seemed to me that there was more in nourishing food than just what I was putting into it, and you yourself had said you did not have as much time as you would like to research the matter. I, on the other hand, have had plenty of time to think. I was quite sure my additions would not be dangerous, and my attendants had become quite ill. I did not like to think everyone in Ardvustia who eats the food I provide might become ill. And you had told me there were few people to spare. I am grateful to have these, and I do not wish to lose them." The dog was silent for a moment, panting. Then he said,
do me the favour, strength and patience of the hill, of telling me when you propose to make such changes again.
I will do so when it seems to me that I can, I replied. Will you also do me the favour of not starving my attendants to death?
Does the turning do anything at all?
He asked.
I noted, of course, that he had not made any promise to do as I asked regarding my attendants.
I am not sure, I replied.
It might. I did not mention the fact that he had done his best to find some way to gain power from it himself. I feared that if I did, it would reveal the fact that I understood a great deal of what my attendants said, and I thought it likely they would thereafter be ordered to silence, or replaced with attendants who would or could not betray him. I certainly did not want any of the gods of Ardvustia to know that I had reached the sea.
"Strength and patience of the hill," said Oisin. "I am concerned that you do not seem to be very forthright with me. Our very existence is at risk here, and we're grateful for what help you can give us. But if you won't commit, won't truly commit to our cause, how do we know it's our cause you support and not another's?"
"Ah," I said, "you wish me to lend you my power directly, so that you may wield it for yourself.
It would be more efficient,"
agreed Oisin. "I can tell you the way to say it that will be most effective."
"Most effective for whom?" I asked.
"Where are the small gods of Ardvustia?"
"You are not a small god,"
Oisin pointed out. "Would it matter if I were?" I asked. "Am I an ally or a resource for you to exploit?"
"I do not see a meaningful difference between the two," Oisin said. "My city is at war. Some will die. Many have already died, but Ardvustia continues. This is my priority. Did you come here with some other aim?"
"I came here because the Myriad is my friend," I said, "and because a god of Iriden threatened the people who camped below me."
"I have heard. You spoke that god dead. A small god could not have done that. Indeed, few gods I know could have done it and lived. You are feeding the city with only the help of a few meagre prayers, and you do not seem fatigued or injured. I think you could well spare us some of your power."
"Tell me the words you would have me say," I replied, "and I will consider them."
"Do not consider too long," replied Oisin, rising. "You might be famous for your patience, but I fear Ardvustia's time is running out."
In the guest house in Vastai, you had pushed the blankets aside and put on your freshly laundered clothes, and now you sat on the edge of the bed, one boot in your hands.
"He said," you told Tikas, "that he could get me into the tower and up to the top without anyone seeing me."
Tikas stood by the closed door, her arms folded, glaring at you.
"And then what?" she asked. "Then I'll go down the other stairs and see what I find there."
You put your foot into your boot, tugged it on, winced.
"At your headache, maybe?"
"Only the lice can come back up from under the tower," she told you angrily. "I thought you won't be able to come back up, or you'll die when you go down there."
"I don't think so." You picked up your other boot. "I've been thinking about this. I've had little else to do since I got here."
Tikas snorted and you went on. "The lice, the previous lice, must still be in the tower. He must be under the tower, or his body must be. It's the only place that wasn't searched, or wasn't searched by anyone but Hebal. After he took the bench," Tikas pointed out.
"So he said. But the lice disappeared before Hebal took the bench, so it seems to me Hebal managed to go down there and come back out without harm.
I suspect the Zulans were involved. At the very least, I think they thought Hebal would give them permission to cross the strait, and they appeared to think they might be able to help Mawat to the bench."
"How could they possibly have been involved?"
Tikas asked, arms still crossed.
"Even if they were, how could that help Hebal go under the tower before he was lice?"
"I said before that I think they've brought a god with them," you told her,
The raven is very powerful, but sometimes even a small god can do more than you'd think. You pulled your second boot on, set both feet squarely, maybe experimentally, on the floor. The Tell bring gods into battle sometimes, very small ones, nothing like the raven, but they can still be dangerous. You have to be careful what you say, what information the Tell might have, because even a small god can take a tiny thing and turn it against you. A weakness in your armour, a resentment against the person fighting beside you. The more they know about how you do things, where you're going and when you'll be there and where you're vulnerable, the easier it is for them to damage you. You stood up, sat down again. "Oh, just a little dizzy," you said. "I should have taken that more slowly." You closed your eyes. "The Lord Hebal, he knows things. About his brother, about how things are done in the fortress and the tower. It might have been a very small thing the Zhulan god did that helped Hebal do whatever he did to the lease. And if that's the case..." You opened your eyes again and looked at Tikaz. "If that's the case, then the raven was unable to stop them for some reason and needs our help.
So maybe he won't kill you when you go below the tower, you mean?"
she said angrily. "Because he'll be grateful." You shrugged. "If I can't come back up, I'll call up what I find."
"And will anyone but Hebal be there to listen to you?"
"Possibly not," you conceded. "That's why I'm telling you what I'm doing. If I don't come back, you'll know what to tell my lord." "Do you love him?" Tikaz asked angrily. You stared at her, frowning, either from your continuing headache or from bewilderment at her question. "Do you love Mawat so much you'll go down and die like this?" You were silent for a bit, and then you said, "When I left home, I had nowhere to go. I thought I could cut my hair and pretend I was much younger and join the fighting. No one would care who I was or where I'd come from if I could pull my weight. And it worked for a while. But then I was injured. Not as badly as I could have been, but badly enough that the doctor found me out. I'd been fighting next to Mawat, so he came to see me, and the doctor told him that, well, the doctor wanted to have me beaten and send me home. Mawat said I deserved better. I'd fought well, and that I'd be one of his aides, and the doctor would keep his mouth shut if he knew what was good for him, and he has lost his temper with me sometimes, but never enough to outweigh the times he's been willing to risk himself to save my life or any other of the people he fights alongside." Tikaz unfolded her arms and sat down on the bed beside you. "I had an aunt, my mother's aunt. Everyone thought she was pretending to be a woman for some reason. But she wasn't. There was a big scandal when she wanted to join the Silent. But she was admitted, and eventually people stopped being so worried about it. That was before I was born. She was an old lady when I knew her, when I used to go with my mother to visit her family. My father always said she should have gone to Ardvustia, where they think such things are normal." "Do they?" you asked with interest. "I've heard it said, but is it true?" Tikaz shrugged. "If people say they do. I've heard that way up north, where it's cold and icy all the time, the gods' favourite priests are all..." She made a vague gesture, searching for a word. "Like my aunt, or like you. I don't know if that's true or just a thing people say. So, why didn't your aunt go to Ardvustia?" you asked. "Why should she have to leave her home?" Tikaz retorted. She folded her arms and glared at you again. "She shouldn't," you said. looking suddenly much younger than I was sure you were. She was lucky in her family.
Yes, agreed Tikaz, her apparent anger gone.
Where's your mother?
You asked.
Is she here in Vastai?
She went back to her family, said Tikaz. West of here. There was only so much of my father she could take. She told me when she left that no matter what my father said, I didn't have to marry anyone I didn't want. And if he tried to make me, I should leave Vastai and come to her.
Ah, he said. And your father wants you to marry my Lord Mawat?
Or get pregnant by him anyway, Tikaz agreed. I don't think Mawat would be a very good husband. What with one thing and another? Not even my father thinks so, really. But he would so like to have a grandchild in striking distance of the bench.
You gave a soft, humourless huh.
Tikaz looked at you shrewdly.
Yes, exactly. I grew up with Mawat. I like him. He's my friend as much as someone in his position can be. And I have to admit, he's attractive. But he's had his way too often, and too easily, I think.
You said,
I can see how he might turn out like his father. If I imagine him taking the bench and having nothing but flattery and everything he wished for. But he's not like that.
Tikaz made a sceptical noise.
He's a little like that, you admitted, but I don't think he means it.
Does it matter if he means it? Tikaz asked.
He knows how much you owe him. You owe him more with every day that goes by.
I'm not his type, you said. He's never even hinted at wanting that sort of thing from me.
Tikaz snorted. I can't see you're not his type, but that hasn't stopped him in the past. Is he your type?
No hesitation, no looking coyly away from you as she asked.
No, you admitted. And anyway, I like men all right, but I generally prefer women.
Do you now? Remarked Tikaz, and unfolded her arms and rose.
I do,
you replied.
What's your type, lady?
She laughed outright. Never you mind that right now. There'll be time enough to talk about it if you're still alive come tomorrow. She turned and left the room, closing the door behind her. And you sat there on the bed with an odd expression on your face, as though you couldn't decide whether or not it was safe to smile. The tower servant met you inside the fortress after dark with an old black overshirt, and once you had put that on over your clothes, bade you say nothing if you were stopped and questioned, and keep your eyes down. And then it was as simple a thing as to walk the two of you unchallenged into the tower and up the stairs to the top. The sky had clouded, the breeze was chill and brisk, and only a few small lanterns burned at the top of the stairs where you came up from below. He picked up one of the lanterns, and you both walked over to the top of those other steps.
Stand here, the servant said to you, and maybe we'll hear what I heard, and you can tell the air that I've spoken the truth.
It's ordinary for you to be up here, is it?
You asked. Yes. No one else will come up here for hours. Everyone else who would has gone to bed.
'Tis no one inside the tower hear these cries?
You asked.
The stones are very thick, he told you, almost whispering.
Oh, maybe it's not a natural sound.
You mean a ghost?
You asked, taken aback. How should I know what it is? All I know is I heard it.
Give me the lantern, you said.
Why?
He asked, handing it to you.
Because it's dark down there?
And before he could protest, you stepped down and into that other stairwell,
leaving the servant behind in astonished silence. At first, as you descended, there were only the stairs and the same yellowish limestone walls as anywhere in the tower. No doors, no landings. Like that other set of stairs that you had already climbed, these spiraled around the circumference of the tower, though the ceiling was close over your head, a good deal closer than on those other stairs. Close enough that someone as tall as Mawat, or Hibal, might have to duck, just a bit, all the way down. Surely as you descended you could hear that ever-present grinding sound, louder as you went. Or perhaps it was such a constant background to the usual noises in the tower that you didn't even notice it. And did you hear the sound of water splashing? You frowned, just slightly, and continued slowly forward, downward. You slowed when your lantern shone on damp stone walls and steps, and then halted where the steps continued down into water. Raised your lantern again. Some 10 or 12 feet farther, steps rose out of the water. You stood there for a few minutes looking at the water, looking at the walls. How deep? You asked yourself quietly. How deep does it get? You turned and looked back the way you had come, the place where wet stone turned to dry. Then you shrugged and stepped slowly down into the water. 2 steps down, the water knee-deep. You nearly stumbled and fell when your foot found not a 3rd step, but a landing. Cautiously, you waded forward until your now sodden boots met the edge of those upward stairs. At the top of those stairs, a doorway. You stepped through it, lantern raised, into a room maybe 10 feet square. The grinding noise was much louder here, unavoidable, unignorable. Directly before you was a massive oak door. To your right, a smaller doorway led to a sort of alcove in which sat stacks of long bones and a pile of skulls. 16 of them, though I don't know if you counted. On your left, you grimaced as the smell hit you. And when you recognised who it was lying on the stone floor of that other alcove opposite the bones, his white clothes dishevelled and stained, his feet pulled back and bound to his hands behind him, you stared with an expression of horror. Even in this extremity his face was so like his brother's, so like his son's, as for there to be little doubt that this was Mawat's father, the Raven's Lease of Iridan, still living, breathing raggedly, eyes closed. What did you feel, seeing the lease? If he still was the lease, now Hibal was lease. Still alive. Mawat could not even admit the possibility of it to himself, was by his own admission holding to the conviction that his father was dead as the one thing in all of this that he could trust. And maybe for Mawat, the stakes were too personal. What would it say about him if his own father had failed in his duty? But of course the lease's failure concerned more than Mawat. What could it mean for Iridan? I believe I have already said that I take you for a thoughtful person. You had more or less openly doubted Mawat's assertion that his father must be dead, and I do not think it was mere idle speculation on your part. And you had heard the tower servant speak of hearing the voice of the previous lease. Surely you were prepared to discover that he was still alive. But considering one disaster among several possibilities is not the same as being confronted with the reality of it. Alive, the whole time. You let out a rough, angry breath and turned away. Fear? Contempt for a coward? Was it the fact that it was not, after all, only Mawat whose world depended on the assumption that the lease would do his duty when the time came? Or was it the realization that freeing Mawat's father now would be pointless? You had no reason to think you could return above. You might be certain that Mawat's father could, but he had lain bound here for days. Could he even walk a few steps
let alone climb those long turning stairs, and even then, in the unlikely event he could manage it, what would happen once he was atop the tower? And once Hebal realized you'd been here? How long had it been since you'd come down here? How long did you have before Hebal came down those stairs and found you? You turned, looked for a moment at the huge wooden door, but instead went to look at the alcove of bones. The bones of Raven's leases, as Tikas had said you would find here. Disarticulated, once the birds had picked them clean, and brought here to be neatly stacked in the centre of this small room. You must have realised what they were. You turned your head to look again at Mawat's father, still bound and unconscious, and then quickly looked away from him. And then, almost reluctantly, you turned again to face that massive wooden door. Your skin prickled, and the hairs on the back of your neck stood up. Surely you knew that whatever was making that unceasing sound, that ever-present grinding, was behind that door. You turned and went back to the stairs and listened a moment. Came back. I think you must have heard me. All this time. Must have felt that someone, something was speaking to you, if you could only understand it. You took a deep breath and reached out for the door. It swung easily under your hand, despite its weight. So finely balanced is that door, so smooth and well-oiled its iron hinges. It may even have swung noiselessly, but the grinding sound would have swallowed any squeak or moan those hinges might have made. Slowly, you pulled the door a few feet open, stepped around it, and raised your lantern, and saw me. That is to say, you saw a massive black stone with feathery white veins. The stone was some 4 feet high and 12 feet in diameter, set in a circular depression cut into the floor of the wide room. Turning. The floor, the walls, the air, your very bones vibrating with the sound of it. You've seen millstones before, I'm sure, but never one as large as I am. I am, in truth, too large to make a good millstone, and I grind nothing but myself and the stone floor. You stared for what must have been a long time to you. And now I could see you closely, see the quick tightness of your breath, feel the fast alarmed beating of your heart. You had, yes, been afraid from the moment you'd started down the stairs, and that fear had only grown as you'd descended, intensified when you'd seen the Raven's Lease bound and unconscious, alive against all expectation, as you realized that whatever secret was hidden down here, it must be behind that huge door. And it must be whatever had been calling to you, subtly, near imperceptibly, since you'd first set foot in the tower. The lantern shook in your hand, the flame wavering. You made yourself breathe more slowly, more deeply. "What is this?" you asked, but you could not even hear your own voice for the grinding. Then you shook your head, took yourself in hand, and walked around me, stopping to look at another door. Much, much smaller than the one you'd come through, though you never entirely took your eyes off me. You finished the circuit of the room. There is nothing else there, just me and those doors, the larger and the smaller, and then tried that smaller door. After some hesitation, you took the narrow steps behind it, down to the mechanism that turns me, which extends up through the floor where I sit, and into a hole drilled in my centre. This is another difference between me and any millstones you may have seen before. Like as not, you've seen one flat stone atop another, with a bar affixed by which people or horses or oxen can turn it. I was turned by a thick wooden shaft that led down from where I spun to a large toothed wooden wheel. That wheel met another wheel, matched tooth by tooth to the first one, with its own huge shaft. Turning, that shaft turned its wheel, which turned the second wheel, which turned my shaft, which turned me. It was powered at least partially by water. It's quite an ingenious arrangement, I'll give the raven that. That said, I've thought of a number of improvements over the years that it might have benefited him to adopt. I have, of course, not shared any of those ideas with him. You watched those wheels and shafts turn for a while, then returned to me. You wanted to flee the room back out onto the stairs, but you made yourself circle me two more times, frowning, trying to understand. As you walked around me, I said, "Now, Aeolo, can you hear me?" You nearly dropped the lantern you held in your still shaking hand. I don't have a mouth. When I speak aloud, it takes effort, and the result does not sound like a human voice. "What?" you began, and tried again.
"What?"
But the sound of your voice was lost in the grinding, and I did not say anything further. At length you went trembling out into the anteroom and swung that huge wooden door closed. The Lee still lay quiet, apparently unconscious. You went past him, out onto the stairs. That once flooded landing was merely wet now, and you walked down to it, and then started up the stairs that led to the top of the tower. But after no more than a dozen steps, you sat down, set the lantern on the stone beside you, and put your head in your hands and made yourself breathe slowly, counting with each inhalation and exhalation.
"This is too much,"
you said at length, quietly into your hands.
"I don't know what's going on. I don't understand."
It had all been bearable, if frightening, until I had spoken to you. That one small thing had tipped your fear over into uncanny terror, the sort one feels when something utterly wrong and utterly inexplicable has happened. But you were a soldier. You had faced death before, and maybe even things you feared more than that.
"My lord needs to know,"
you said, and looked up, made yourself pick up the lantern and stand, though I could see that what you really wanted was to run as far away from me as you could, somewhere quiet where you could hide. But you did not run. You went resolutely on up the stairs. Footsteps sounded somewhere above you. You spun, came quickly and quietly as you could back down to that landing and up to the antechamber, looked around you and went into the alcove of bones, lay down behind the skulls in a pile of femurs and tibias, and doused the light in your lantern. Rested your head on the floor. But there was a lump there under your cheek. It hurt. One end of it poking into your face, and quickly, before Hebal could come through the door, for who could be coming down those stairs but Hebal, you raised your head just a bit and scrabbled for whatever had jabbed you so painfully, coming away with something oblong and round, strung on a cord. You wrapped your hand around it and lay your head back down. Hebal came into the room, lantern in hand, walked over to where his brother lay and prodded him with one booted foot. "Hey, you. Are you still alive, then?" The Lys opened his eyes. "Can you still smell yourself?" asked Hebal. "Or do you get used to it after a while?"
"Let me free," said the Lys, in a weak but still agonized voice. Let me free, you shit-eating dog.
Ybal laughed. If I untie you now, you'd barely be able to crawl to the door.
Then kill me. You're what you want. You've finally taken my place, and you've made damn sure I know it. Well, now I know it. What use am I after that?
Oh, no use at all, brother, said Ybal. Except, so long as the raven is still alive, not his instrument but the god himself, you can't die except by sacrificing yourself to him. So when you die, I'll know the god is dead too.
You bit your lip to keep yourself from making a noise.
I'll know the god is dead too.
Ybal didn't just want to sit on the bench. He wanted to kill the Raven of Iriden. He wanted to kill a god.
It won't matter much for anyone but you and the Raven, really,
Ybal continued.
All the prayers and offerings of every person in Iriden are not enough to keep him alive. He needs the death of the least to do that. I imagine he wishes he hadn't agreed to take only that one occasional human sacrifice.
You're wrong, said Mauat's father. The Raven is a powerful god. He'll destroy you for this.
The Raven hasn't had the strength to do anything at all for Iriden for nearly 100 years. That...
Ybal gestured toward the massive wooden door, behind which I sat turning.
Has been sustaining Iriden for decades now.
No,
groaned the Lise.
Oh, yes, brother. The Raven has overstretched himself somehow, and you know it. If you didn't know before you took the bench, it was because you never paid any attention to the ships that pass through the strait, except as far as they brought you money and luxuries, and you never travelled anywhere except the other side of the forest to crack tell heads. And then, once you did know it, you had to know it when you first came down here and saw that.
He gestured again toward me.
Once you did know it, what did you do? Nothing. When you could have solved the whole problem the way I have, wringing the miserable bird's neck and waiting for the god to die. You could have done it as soon as you became least, just broken the egg and put another in its place.
Then what?
Asked the Lise.
Without the Raven, there is no Lise. Who will protect Iriden then?
Ybal made a pfft sound, inaudible over the background noise of me in the next room turning.
As far as the lease goes, nobody wants to rebuild the government. Nobody wants to give up the power they already have. The Council of the Directions is more concerned with their own petty squabbles than with a Raven, and the House of the Silent isn't any better. Indeed, they're an example to me. The forest hasn't said or done anything in ages, not anything that mattered, and yet people still make their offerings, and the House of the Silent still holds its power over us. When I'd be willing to bet, the god that is the reason for that power is long gone. And by the time this thing here,
he gestured again toward the room where I was,
stops doing what it's been doing, the Raven's job is what it's been doing all this time, by the time whatever god powers it dies, we'll have already invited another god in, or a few gods who'll be grateful for the worshippers. Do you know how many eager, hungry gods there are out in the world beyond Iriden's borders? Doubtless some have seen how things stood, and have been looking for decades for a way into power here. If I'd left things to you, they'd have swept down on us as soon as the Raven's power failed, as soon as that thing there failed. But now I'm Lise. We can prepare for it.
You're not Lise, said the Lise.
I am in the only way that matters, said Ybal.
When Mauat's father didn't answer, Ybal shrugged and went into my room to watch me turn. After a few minutes, he went away, up the stairs to the top of the tower again. You waited where you were for a while longer, and then, the thing you had found on the floor still clutched in your hand, You crept around the pile of bones, feeling your way out onto the stairs. All this time, the lease made no sound you could hear. Your reaching hands found the first step down, and carefully, cautiously, you descended and stopped when you touched water. Perhaps sooner than you'd expected, water had begun to fill the landing again. For whatever reason, I can think of few, but I don't doubt there are others, when the Raven Tower was built, the Raven wanted to be certain that what was under the tower stayed safely secret. But he also wanted his lease and himself to be able to easily reach what he'd put there. It's true that the Raven did indeed say that only himself and the lease could go under the tower and come back up again. And then he made certain that as many people as possible in the fortress knew that. In some ways, that knowledge alone is safeguard enough, but of course, there are also guards to be sure no one enters the tower or climbs the stairs to the top who is not supposed to be there. And then there's the water. That landing fills and empties with the tide, the idea being, I gather, that the unwary might be easily trapped so, and the more cautious, well, even for a god, it's easier to kill someone when one has something to kill them with. You had been under the tower for some time, and the tide was rising again. Did you realize that? Perhaps, because after crouching a moment on the step, your hand in the water, heart pounding, you crept down another stair into the water, carefully down to the landing and across, and up again. And then you crawled slowly and steadily up the dark stairway until you saw dim daylight, when you stood and walked, and stopped entirely when you saw sunlight on the stone, stopped short of that bar of sunlight, and listened. Well, you've always told us it was important to take initiative, Askell's voice, petulant. You said yourself that if he wouldn't be convinced, he was going to have to be dealt with somehow. Arkim's voice now, and he wasn't going to be convinced, insolent, self-important. It just made sense to get him out of the way. Askell cut him off. Not that you've done a very good job of that. Hibel. Well, I'd think you'd thank us. Arkim again. He hasn't come out of his room since they carried him into it. He must be more badly off than he seemed at first. Sometimes a blow to the head will do that. He sounded satisfied at the thought. He deserves whatever he gets. He broke my nose. And stabbed me, put in Askell. But he's not important. It's Mawat who's the problem, and we can't just knife Mawat in an alley, much as we'd like to sometimes, put in Arkim. Well, apparently you couldn't knife Aeolo in an alley either, said Hibble. We didn't know he'd be so quick, said Askell. It doesn't matter, said Hibble. As you say, it's Mawat who's the problem, and Mawat we have to deal with, and I will deal with him. But it's going to take subtlety. If he just stayed sulking in his room, it would have been easy enough to be rid of him. I have to be careful now he's publicly attacked me and drawn the attention of all Vastai. He made a frustrated noise. Going to such extremes so quickly you'd think he'd risk looking like a spoilt, petulant child who everyone can see is unworthy of the bench. But he doesn't seem to care about that so long as he gets his way. He never does, said Arkim, so long as he gets his way. And if he's successful, Hebel continued, he risks the wrong sort of success. The people of Vastai in open revolt against the lease. And no easy way to resolve that, since the Raven isn't the power he once was. But Raven or no Raven, Vastai in open revolt would likely be as bad for him as for me. And he doesn't seem to realize that or care. He's certainly his father's son. And the longer he sits there, the more likely it is people will be convinced he's in the right, or at least question my presence on the bench, before I can establish myself as firmly as I'd like. The sooner I deal with him, the better. But panic and rashness won't serve me, nor will they serve you. Watch and wait. Be shrewd.
learn patience.
Patience? Cried Arkim. We've had plenty of patience, Raven's lease. Patience as we watch Mowat fawned over and ourselves ignored or spit on.
And himself doing some of the spitting. No one insults us or makes the forest sign at us in Ardvulftia. And it's you who've called us over here to endure all that again. We've been patient.
You've done very well for yourselves in Ardvulftia,
Hebal said,
with my help. And you'll do even better there in the future, if things go as I wish.
The servant who helps keep Mawat's temper in check is bedridden and unable to attend him. Sooner or later, he'll lose that temper publicly, in a way that will lose the sympathy of the people. And I'll be forced to...
Hebal's voice faded as they moved away from the stairs. You waited, still, but there was nothing else to hear beside the crying of gulls and that faint, grinding noise that I was sure now that you heard. And finally, you came up out of the stairwell. No one was there. You took a deep breath and walked confidently to the other stairs and down them as though you were just another black-shirted servant who belonged there on those stairs in the tower. Walked out into the fortress yard. No one looked at you. No one spoke to you. In a shadow behind the kitchens, you pulled the black shirt off, one-handed, still walking, dropped it and continued on, out the fortress gate, into the square. You walked up to Mawat, still sitting naked on a pile of blankets. "My lord," you said. He did not reply, did not even give the slightest impression that he had heard you or seen you, though you stood right in front of him and spoke in an ordinary voice. "My lord." Still nothing. For the first time since I'd seen you, I thought you might be near tears. And no wonder, after such a night and day as you'd had. "My lord," you said again. No response. You turned then and walked into the guest house. The Julans weren't there. The few people sitting at the tables didn't look at you as you passed. The landlady's daughter walked right by you with a pitcher of beer without even a glance. You closed your eyes, took a deep breath, opened your eyes.
"Am I invisible?"
you asked. No one seemed to hear you. You looked down at your hands, and I suppose that it was only then that you realized that your fist was still closed around whatever you'd found in the chamber of bones. You opened your hand. The landlady's daughter, on her way back to the kitchen, gave a little shriek.
"Oh, sir, you startled me. Wherever did you come from? I almost ran into you."
You stared at her, blinking.
I'm sorry. "It's all right, sir," she said. "I should be more careful where I'm going. And you with your sore head." "No, it was my fault," you said,
and looked at what you held. It was a cylinder of rolled leather. Two ends of a cord had been strung through the centre and then knotted to keep it on, so that the knot lodged on one end of the cylinder and the loop of the cord was on the other. Wrapped around the leather, spiralling down, was a thin strip of snake-shed skin. You slipped the cord over your head, letting the cylinder fall under your shirt, and went back out to speak to Mawat.